Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into an all-new episode of the Can We Please Talk podcast. As always, I'm Mike Leon. I'm flying solo today. You don't hear my co-host Nick Saveri chiming in. He's a little bit under the weather. We'll see him in a bit. I've got a guest host jumping on in just a little bit, former federal prosecutor. You can watch him across CNN, BBC News, Fox News, breaking down all the legal news and notes of the week, and that's Joseph Moreno. He's going to be joining me in just a bit. We're going to talk about the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, obviously all the cases involving the former president. We're going to ask a former federal prosecutor if he's Trumped out. Is he checking out? That's it. I can't do it anymore. I can't break down any more legal news surrounding a former president. Or I do like breaking it down because you know what? This has never happened before. Some of this stuff is unprecedented. Find out what Joseph says to me in the next segment as we break down all of that stuff across the different jurisdictions that the former president is charged in. First, I want to give a shout out. First off, go to leonmedianetwork.com. You can watch all the shows that have been happening across the network. Some great stuff out there. You can go check out an all-new episode of the If You Lead Them podcast, which is out there. Katie Barnett, if you don't know that show, leadership and coaching. Hear from some of the best leaders out there in the business. She just did a great episode this past week with Tim Brannion, who jumped on the podcast. He's a former Air Force veteran, tech entrepreneur. This guy has launched tons of companies, and he really breaks down the need for having a clear vision and how it's necessary in helping to influence and impact others. All new episodes each week of the If You Lead Them podcast over on leonmedianetwork.com. Listen wherever you get your pods. All new episode of the Educate US podcast. My co-host, Moonlights, along with Stacey Schultz and Patrice Fenton over on the education podcast that they have here at Leon Media Network. You can go listen to it on leonmedianetwork.com or wherever you get your pods. This week, Nick and Stacey had on the founder and CEO of Charter School Business Management, as well as the Foresight Financial Services for Good, Raj Thacker. A conversation on charter schools, financial literacy in schools, all of that and more. He's also the author of the book, Fiscally Secure: Prepare and Protect and Propel Your Charter School with Responsible Financial Management. You should go listen to that episode over on leonmedianetwork.com or wherever you get your pods. The last one, we got so many shows here on the network, folks, so I got to give you all of them. Back Your Play with Q is out there, an all-new episode over on leonmedianetwork.com or listen wherever you get your pods. Q's breaking down the latest with the NCAA Women's Final Four. If you'd missed that championship game between Iowa and South Carolina, the Lady Gamecocks, I think it's the Lady Gamecocks, but They finished the season 38-0, didn't lose to anybody, lost all of their players from last year, come back with a brand new team, win the national championship, and in the process beat Caitlin Clark, and in the process revolutionize how many people, I don't know if revolutionize is the right word, they changed, the forever changed the women's college basketball landscape. 18.7 million people watched that game Sunday at 3 p.m. on ABC. 18.7 million people. It's the most watched basketball game, men's or women's, in a long, long time, I think ever. So awesome stuff. Rich breaks it all down, plus the men's tournament and what's happening there as we're recording this. The finals happening between Purdue and UConn. So no spoiler alerts for some of you listening, even though you already know who won as you listen to this. But on your episode of Back Your Play with Q, go listen to it wherever you get your pods. Follow Q across social media, Rich Q on Q. Go check out the YouTube channel. Some great interviews that he's done there. NFL breaking down the offseason, the Shohei Ohtani, stuff that's been happening with him. All of that stuff, you know, NFL free agency. He's been doing a great job. So go follow all his stuff there. We're going to get into Joseph in just a bit. I wanted to let you all know, obviously, Nick's a little bit under the weather. He'll be joining us, you know, obviously in the next episode. We've got some great stuff planned out for April, but there's a lot of news going on out there. I mean, obviously the war in Gaza is still playing out between Israel and Hamas. The hostages still haven't come back home. You know, we're almost on what? October 7th to now is what my math, it sucks. 6 months already. No news of these hostages. And we saw what happened. The deadly strike on the World Central Kitchen folks and the seven people that innocently lost their lives. We're going to be doing something around the latest in the wars, not only in Gaza, but also in Ukraine as well, coming up soon. So we're going to be devoting some coverage to that. The campaigns are hot and heavy right now going on. The trials of the former president are at front and center, potentially for voters, maybe, if they start to look at issues when they get to the ballots. You know, the primary process is almost completed here, even though we've had some recent stuff in Wisconsin. Oh, you know, 70,000 people or so voting for Nikki Haley. She has dropped out a month ago. All of that stuff, we're going to be breaking all that stuff down when Nick comes back over the next couple of weeks. But enjoy this episode. Because, you know, there's a central through line that Joseph and I kind of talk about in the next segment. And it's really about, are we Trumped out? You know, I when I started thinking about this, as I started recording this, I feel like sometimes I'm super tired of the former president. But there is some, you know, kind of Trumped out in terms of the coverage and in terms of the same people that are kind of analyzing this stuff, and you're getting their opinions, and you don't know which is opinion, which is fact. And at the core of it, I truly think that it should be the legalities of these cases. Are these cases on the up and up? And why are they on the up and up? And what is right now going to be introduced from an evidentiary standpoint by the prosecution to warrant these cases being on the up and up? Whether or not they play out before the election, doesn't look like any of them will outside of the New York one, which Joseph's going to tell you in a little bit why it's potentially the weakest of that. Again, and as a former federal prosecutor, he's going to tell you why he probably wouldn't have brought this one. But we're all going to see it all play out. And there is a part of me that is a little tired about it. And then there's the other part where I think, well, you know what? We've never had this happen before. We truly have never seen anything like this. Nixon resigned before he was even going to go to trial for any of this stuff. So nothing came about it. No prosecutor was going to indict him as a former president because he had decided to resign. As you heard former Trump attorney Timothy Balotori tell us when he came on the show maybe a month or so ago, he said, normally you don't have this happen because the person drops out in whatever, you know, political standing they have, whether they're a senator, a U.S. House representative, a vice president, whatever it is, they normally tend to drop out. They don't run for re-election. So you don't have to deal with this. They can go face whatever legal issues on their own and they're kind of disassociated. The issue here is the former president's running for the highest office in the land again. And so the thought of, well, what happens if he wins? Are any of these trials going to happen? What happens if he loses? In 25 is our focus only Donald Trump trials. You think we're trumped out now. Wait till 2025 if he doesn't win. So anyway, enjoy this episode. I thought about all these things. If you are thinking about these things as well, and you're like, you know, I want to talk about this, email us. Can we please talk podcast at gmail.com? Nick and I have read the emails on the episodes before, and we'll happily do it again. I want to continue the conversation. Continue to email us, follow us on social media, TikTok and Instagram at Can We Please Talk Podcast, on Twitter at Can We Please Talk. We truly appreciate the feedback. Nick loves it, even when you rankle some of his feathers. He loves it. He knows he does. And he'll be back in the next episode. But for now, enjoy this interview I recorded with former federal prosecutor Joseph Moreno when we come back after the break. Nick, today's episode is presented, as always, by our friends over at Fresh Roasted Coffee. Since 2009, their passion has always been bringing you gourmet coffees from all over the world, roasted fresh to order. I got my coffee snob here, Nick Saveri. Nick, tell these people, coffee snob it up here, tell these people why Fresh Roasted Coffee is so good and why they're the official sponsor of Can We Please Talk?
You know, often the best cup of coffee that you're ever going to have is the one you can make from home. And you need good quality coffee to do that. And that's what Fresh Roasted Coffee offers. You know, between single origin, between blends, flavors, anything on the coffee spectrum they've got. But more importantly, and I can't stress this enough, often when you purchase coffee, you don't know where to start. I mean, there's so many different varieties, so many different opportunities, so many different things you could choose from. And Fresh Roasted Coffee just gives you a very simple questionnaire and just says, hey, figure out what your coffee cup is. Figure out what blend works for you. I've gotten some single origin recommendations, so has Mike, and that's influenced everything. And what they recommend, you can get in a Keurig cup, the way Mike takes it. You can take it in the way I do it, which is typically through a French press, or you can get it for a percolator. Whatever coffee machine you've got, they got you covered. But more importantly, just a huge variety and a way to learn more about coffee itself.
And all of this is available at freshroastedcoffee.com on their site. One cup is all it takes to fall in love with Fresh Roasted Coffee, but you get a discount for being a listener of Can We Please Talk. Enter in the promo code Can We Please Get 20 to get 20% off your first purchase. Head to freshroastedcoffee.com today. Quick break from the pod. As always, we are presented by our friends over at SeatGeek. If you need tickets to the biggest concerts, shows, sporting events, MLB season that's starting up this coming week, you got the NBA and NHL playoffs coming up soon, SeatGeek has got you covered. Nick, did you download the SeatGeek app like I told you?
Did. We're excited to use it because we've got, obviously, the Phillies starting up this season. So I'm excited to take my girls out there and just take full advantage of the perks we get as partners.
That's right, as you should. As should our audience right now. So if you're watching or listening to this, when you download the app, put the tickets in the cart. When you hit the checkout, there's going to be a little promo code field right there. Do me a favor, enter in the promo code Can We Please Talk, all one word. You're going to get $20 off that purchase. Download the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com to get your tickets today. All right, kind enough to give us a couple of minutes here to talk about former President Trump and all the legal cases that are going to be coming up over the next couple of months, maybe years, who knows? Some other legal news is former federal prosecutor Joseph Moreno. Joseph, welcome back on the podcast.
Mike, good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming back on. You know, I'm glad Nick is not here because I wanted to ask you some questions. Now that Nick is not here, now we can kind of relax a little bit, right? We're gonna get into the weeds here of legal beagle stuff. You know, one guy who took his law degree at St. John's, and then another guy who, you know, thought about going to law school at Rutgers. So I wanted to ask you high level. The former president, all of these cases, I'm going to play some sound for you in a little bit of something he said recently outside of the courthouse on one of these trials. But as a TV contributor now across BBC, CNN, whatever, are you feeling trumped out? And I ask this because, you know, I get this question a lot. Nick and I get this question a lot in terms of what we do for our show. Now, our show is a little bit different. It's news commentary. We're talking about different issues. There's the war playing out in the Middle East and Ukraine and stuff like that. So we have different people of all time. But then, like, right now, there's like this quiet period in America and the campaigns are slowly starting to ramp up. And then it's like, what else can you talk about? But I'm a little bit tired of talking about the former president, but he is running for the highest office in the land. As a legal analyst across these networks, are you trumped out at any point here? How do you feel about it all?
You know, Mike, it's funny you say that. There's definitely Trump fatigue syndrome here. I feel like we've talked about nothing else for the past going on 8 years now. And between, as you point out, the combination of this being an election year where Trump is now running for a third time, as well as the four upcoming criminal cases that he's facing, it's going to be Trump legal 24/7 for the next 8 months. And yes, I think it is fatiguing. I think a good portion of the country is probably pretty tired of a lot of this and just kind of wish it would go away. I can tell you, as a person who does, you know, a handful of TV hits a week, when I get an opportunity to talk about anything other than Trump, I jump at it. Just because it's like, my gosh, something other than what the orange-haired guy from Queens is doing tonight. What has he said lately? What's the latest theory about him? What sort of nonsense headline has he generated this time? So yes, I think it would be very good for all of us to move on. I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately, anytime soon. But yes, I think, like many others, are definitely trumped out.
Well, I sent you the rundown earlier. Get ready for like six questions on Trump coming up here. But no, I think there's people like me, I would say, that want to learn a little bit more about the cases themselves, always been fascinated by the legal system and all of that. And so when you see these different jurisdictions and then sometimes you see, wait a minute, went to the appellate court? I don't get it. I thought it was just, you know, in the district court and now it's moving over here. Do you get at least some enjoyment from at least explaining the bare bones legalities around it?
Yes, I think it's always good to be an explainer and try to synthesize a lot of information that's out there and help people who are not attorneys, who are not regularly tuned into politics, to understand it in short amounts of time. And I do think that's satisfying and it can be a lot of fun. For me, I also think it's important, beyond just being an explainer, to give a certain degree of opinion on kind of where things stand. And I think Trump is, he's very polarizing, right? I can't imagine anyone in recent history that people either love or hate more than Donald Trump. And I think when it comes to these legal cases, I think it's people are very quick to also go where their political leanings go. So if you really don't like Trump, you think these cases are fantastic and he should go to jail and he's a bad guy. And if you like Trump, you think it's all lawfare and it's all nonsense and it's just all being sort of unfairly piled on him. And I get some enjoyment out of saying it's not necessarily the legal analysis is not necessarily the political analysis. And I've given my thoughts on these cases against him. And I'd say, let's say I kind of count five, the four criminal cases and the one civil case in New York by Attorney General Letitia James, which is concluded, but we're going to keep hearing about it on appeal. And I think from a lawyer's perspective, I think these cases range from very strong in terms of the Florida Mar-a-Lago classified documents case to a little shaky, which I think is the January 6th federal case here in Washington and maybe the RICO case in Fulton County, where there's a basis there, but there are some legal jumps that could be difficult for the prosecution. And then I think there's the New York criminal case and the civil case, which I think are borderline nonsense. I think those cases are really, really poorly constructed. Doesn't mean they're not going to work. I mean, Trump's already been found liable in the civil case and the criminal case is starting in 7 days. We'll see how that goes. But again, my point is, I think it's really important to look at these cases one by one and try to separate your personal view of Trump from the merits of each case, because they're not the same. And I think it's important to kind of call out what are the theories behind each of them, and are they strong or are they weak?
Joseph, you mean you fed into all the follow-ups I was going to ask you, because you just broke down each of them. So now, and you gave the weakest, to strongest, which are some of the same things that I've echoed as well on television. It's very tough for people to remove themselves from how they feel about the former president. So let's try to stay in that vein, because that's the purpose of Nick and I's show. It's why we started it. We really try to be the umpires in all of this in terms of calling balls and strikes and talking about the game from an analytical perspective. So I want to ask you, let's start first with the one that you kind of said about the January 6th stuff, because there was something that recently happened. Let's go to the Mar-a-Lago classified documents first, because a federal judge recently in Florida denied the motion by the former president to dismiss the charges against him. So you think that this one is the strongest of the cases against him right now? So we'll go from strongest to mild to weakest. Why do you feel that it is the strongest? And then what about the Florida judge dismissing this? What's the latest that you can tell us and break down in that case?
Sure. So in the simplest terms, right, Donald Trump had in his possession government materials that were permissible for him to have in Florida while he was in office, but which he should not have had in his possession a minute after he left office. The fact that they are classified makes it even worse. But even beyond just the classification issue, which we could talk about, I think people have to think of these as it's government property, right? We call presidential property, meaning they are the property of the office, not the individual who sits in the office and later is no longer in office. So there's presidential property and there's personal property. So there are things that a president can take with him or her when they leave office, but there's a distinction under the law that has to be made. But Donald Trump, now he's gonna say all those boxes of documents in Florida were personal property. That's his argument. I think that's gonna be a difficult argument, because when you remove classified or unclassified, it doesn't really matter. When you remove government property from the government, there's a process to do that. And you work through the National Archives. And if it's classified, there's additional processes because there's information in there that's sensitive. Donald Trump didn't follow any of those procedures. He shipped them down to Florida when he was in office or as he's leaving office. And then he was untruthful about it when the government asked for it back. So first they asked nicely, and for about a year, the National Archives negotiated with Trump's lawyers to get those boxes of documents back. And Trump kind of dribbled back a few of them, but the archives had reason to believe he had more. And so ultimately, the archives threw up its hands and say, we're not getting anywhere. And they turned it over to the FBI. And the FBI, which has a little more heft, they don't have to just ask nicely, they can serve a subpoena and say, now we're telling you to give these documents back. And then Donald Trump gave it a certain number more of those documents he handed over. And the government still had reason to believe he had more. And only when they raided the compound did they find the remainder of the documents. So now, not only did he have government materials when he was out of office that he should not have had, but then there's the argument he also obstructed justice by lying to the FBI by saying he's handed over all those records when in fact he had kept some. And so that's the basics of the case. It doesn't sound complicated, but what does complicate it is the fact, one, that these documents were classified and the president has a unique power to declassify documents. So there's gonna be a whole fight in there about whether they were classified or whether Donald Trump declassified them. And there's all that gonna go, that's gonna have been a whole lot of back and forth there. Then there is the unique question also about this Presidential Records Act and whether or not what a president is or is not allowed to keep with him when he leaves office. And so that's what's kind of complicate the case. And that's what's raised some headlines in the last week about the latest before Judge Cannon down in Florida. But all that being said, the facts of the case are pretty straightforward. Again, Donald Trump had information, had documents he wasn't supposed to have. And when he was asked to turn them back in, the argument is he lied about it and didn't turn them over. So, I don't see him having really good defenses to the case. I think he's gonna try to argue the Presidential Records Act. I think it's a weak argument, and I think that it's gonna fail, but it's never been used before because we've never had a president charged in a case like this, or any case for that matter. So that's gonna cause some time. The fact that they're classified means there's a whole process they have to go through under something called the Classified Information Procedures Act just to get classified information into evidence. That takes a lot of time. So that's going to add months, possibly even years to the case. And then there's the obstruction angle, which is not that complicated, really. But anyway, put it all together. It's not going to be a quick case. There's no way it's happening before the election, but it's a solid case. And I think Donald Trump is going to have his hands full in defending against it.
You know, there was two things that you said there, and I kind of want to piggyback off of them. But first, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about this. The jury trial, the instructions that they were weighing, Judge Cannon was weighing. I would love for you to kind of explain this, because I think at the central core of this is the jury would have to determine if something should be classified or not, like you were saying before. And that's kind of out of the purview of what a juror should do, because as people have told me, former FBI agents that handled espionage and espionage related crimes, it's like, hey, man, you don't work here. Like, you don't know what these documents are and the sensitivities around them. That all of that stuff is kind of classified information. So can you kind of break down a little bit of what Judge Cannon was proposing and why Jack Smith is so adamant, the special prosecutor is so adamant about not having these instructions for the jury before the trial?
Well, so this goes to the fact that I said the facts of this case are not that difficult, but the law around this case has some wrinkles to it because, again, it's never been done before. And so if let's say you have a murder case, right? In a murder case, the law is pretty straightforward, right? Whether you're at a state level, you're in New York State, or you're in Florida, wherever, this murder statute has been used to prosecute people for decades, right? So you know the elements of what the prosecutor has to show beyond reasonable doubt. And really, you're just fighting over the facts, right? Did the person do whatever it is the government says that they did? Can the government prove those facts beyond a reasonable doubt? And will a jury vote to convict? Pretty simple. In this case, in the classified documents case, there are a number of legal issues that have never been worked out before. So again, it kind of questions about what can a president legally take with him? What is the president's power to declassify? If the president does declassify something, what does he have to show to prove that he did it? All of these legal issues that have to get worked out at the trial court level, which is pretty unusual, because usually these things have been worked out, you know, long in advance, and all they're fighting about is the facts. So what Judge Cannon did was she, in trying to understand the legal theories that both the prosecution and the defense are going to bring to trial, she asked for both sides to propose jury instructions under two potential scenarios. The first one was the scenario of assuming the Presidential Records Act does apply here, and that a president has the ability to designate presidential property versus personal property that the president can take with him. The first instruction was, if the jury is willing to determine if property is presidential versus personal, and that would hinge on whether the president is guilty or not guilty of violating the Espionage Act. And so that was the instruction to say, jurors, each one of you may need to make the determination of whether or not this was personal property or presidential property. And you would do that through testimony, right? The government would say, normally a president would do X, Y, and Z to designate something personal. You'd log it in an archive, you'd fill out this form, it would go through lawyers and so on. The prosecution's gonna say, here, Trump didn't do any of that. And so he just kind of made up in his mind these things that are personal property. And he didn't follow any of the steps that he should have followed. So anyway, that's one jury instruction, the first one that Judge Cannon asked each side to propose. The second one is basically saying to the jury, if you find that these documents that Donald Trump had were in fact personal property, then the Presidential Record Act will apply. And basically, he'd have to be found not guilty. So Jack Smith is furious at both of these, right? The first one, it kind of puts this question that he doesn't believe the Presidential Records Act should even apply here. The first one is giving the jury the power to decide whether it applies. The second one, if the jury instruction is given, basically the case is dead, because if it's personal property, then Donald Trump can't be found had to be liable for having improperly kept it. So Jack Smith did write a pretty searing response to the judge. He was respectful, but he was pretty adamant that he felt she was really off base in terms of bringing this Presidential Records Act into the analysis here. And I'm not trying to defend Judge Cannon. I have no idea, you know, what kind of a jurist she is. I will say, though, she's dealing with a very complicated case that's never been worked through before. So I understand why she's doing this. She's trying to basically anticipate the legal arguments that both sides are going to bring into trial and not figure them out in front of the jury. She's trying to figure them out before it goes to the jury. But she's in a tough spot. And so I also think I wouldn't be surprised if, depending on how she accepts, whether she accepts these jury instructions from either side, you might see appeals happen before the trial even begins. If one side or the other feels so adamantly that the instructions that she's accepting are wrong, they can, and so you might see this go to appeal now before the first day of trial even begins. And this could take, again, a very long time to work out before you hear even one witness testify in this case.
You know, we had former Trump attorney Timothy Pallitteri on the program before. I wanted to play something for you here of something he said about the broken process of the National Archives and collecting documentation, because he was on the team trying to get Merrick Garland to not file charges in this. So take a listen to this.
I'll tell you the thing that really jumped out at me about this report is I went back to, you know, to my own work in the Mar-a-Lago case, and we had written a letter to the House and Senate Intel committees, you know, right towards the end, right before I left, where we did a deep analysis of how these documents got out of the White House to begin with. And we wrote it in a way that was applicable to President Trump, President Biden, and Vice President Pence. Because the reality is, what this case shows beyond a shadow of a doubt, what the Trump case shows beyond a shadow of a doubt, is that the White House does not have proper document handling procedures. They do not follow the same procedures that the Department of Defense follows, that the intelligence community follows. And so the reason why these documents left government control to begin with is because of a failure of document handling procedures within that institution.
Well, there's no doubt that it's obviously not an isolated incident of political figures who are not handling classified documents in the most careful way. And so the fact that they're popping up in different places is not a great thing. And the system is, I'd say, somewhat broken as far as the lack of accountability about why these documents are leaving secure spaces and who's carrying them around. So I think that's a problem there. As far as the National Archives, there's not much of an enforcement mechanism that they have. All they can basically do is ask nicely. And I'm sure that they were asking nicely to Donald Trump for those months. And I had read reports that there were some back and forth negotiations about the handling of these documents. I think had I been advising former President Trump, I would have said, look, we might think these are yours to keep based on one theory under the Presidential Records Act, but just to be sure, why don't we hand them back over and we can negotiate with the documents back in the custody of the government, be very basically cooperative. But by keeping them and then after getting the subpoena, still not turning over all of them, you kind of put yourself in a spot now where you're almost daring the government not to charge you. And I have heard the theory put forth that Jack Smith could have made this a lot easier by skipping the Espionage Act charges, which are all the classified documents charges, and just focusing on the obstruction. Would have made it a heck of a lot simpler case, because then all you're doing is saying, was Trump truthful in responding to a subpoena or not? That's pretty straightforward. And you're not going to get into all the Presidential Records Act classified, non-unclassified stuff. But that's not the way they went. So, you know, look, I have heard people say if Donald Trump had just cooperated, he would have gotten a pass. He would not have been prosecuted. Maybe, you know, maybe that's the case. That Cooperation does not negate the underlying crime. It may help on sentencing. So either when President Biden says, "Well, I cooperated when they found documents in my house," and they say, "Well, Donald Trump didn't cooperate when they found documents in his house," well, it doesn't change the fact of whether the underlying crime was committed, but it certainly does help in your sort of argument about why prosecutors should go easy on your client.
You know, let's shift now because you gave a timeline at the beginning before about strongest, mid, as the kids like to say, Joseph, and then you had weakest. So let's go with the mid ones. I think I'm saying that correctly, by the way, for anybody under 21 that listens to this. So let's go with the mid one. What's happening in Georgia with District Attorney Fannie Willis? You know, over the last month or so, you know, you and I haven't talked, but I have seen you on television commenting about this and. This improper, or at least the appearance of an improper relationship with a prosecutor that you help, you know, appoint to this case, Nathan Wade, who happened to be her boyfriend, et cetera. All of this in this pretrial motion went down in Georgia. And now Nathan Wade, I believe, is not going to be working on the case anymore. Fannie Willis is going to be taking a larger role in terms of the prosecution. What did you make of everything that's happening with the Georgia case? Because from what I've heard from other legal analysts, it's that Fannie Willis should have never had brought this because it's covered in some of Jack Smith's indictments in terms of, you know, the charges that he's bringing. What do you make of the charges overall? Because you said it before about where they kind of lie in this timeline of what he's going through trial-wise. But then what'd you make of the spectacle of Fannie Willis and the improper relationship in that motion?
I think it, for this one, I think it's again important to look at the sort of dramatic developments we've learned in the last few months about Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade, separate from the quality of the case. And I think they're two different things. I think her relationship with her chief prosecutor was an unfortunate, unforced error. I think it showed poor judgment. I think that in a case like this, a high-profile case against a former president, you want to be sort of everything to be, you know, totally clean, totally above board, avoid any appearances of any kind of impropriety. So I think it was really poor judgment in her case, in her situation. All that being said, though, I think the case has to be looked at separately. And I never thought the case would be dismissed as a result of her relationship. I thought the worst that would happen was they would give it to another prosecutor. And in this case, I think, like you said, Nathan Wade is going to step aside now. I think putting all that aside, I think the case is shaky for a couple of reasons. I mean, this is a what they call a RICO case, right? A racketeer-influenced corrupt organization case. They are usually federal, but Georgia has its own state-level RICO statute, and so that's what Ms. Willis is applying here. The problem is, to have a corrupt organization case, you have to have an organization. You have to have an entity, a group of people, a corporation, organized crime family, some kind of ongoing organization that exists for the purpose of committing crimes and basically earning money, right? An ongoing criminal enterprise where at some point, even just membership in that corrupt organization is enough to involve you in the RICO case. So even if every individual person didn't commit every individual crime over the course of the history of the organization, at some point, just being a member of the mafia family, of the corrupt corporation, is enough to embroil you in this RICO case. So now look at the theory against Donald Trump. The theory there is that there was this collection of individuals that got together between Election Day 2020 and Inauguration Day 2021, right? So you got about 3 months there where they engage in all these different efforts to try to basically flip the election from Joe Biden to Donald Trump. And they, in the process of doing this in Georgia, they made phone calls to state officials, some that Trump were on himself, others that people like Rudy Giuliani and others, Mark Meadows, engaged in. There were some efforts to affect some voting machines. There were some efforts to potentially intimidate some vote counters and things like that. So But does that constitute an organization in the typical concept of how we consider organizations under RICO cases? Does a loose group of people whose purpose ended on inauguration day, January 20th, does that constitute an organization? So that's the first problem there. The second problem is it's hard to understand what exactly Ms. Willis is alleging in terms of crimes, right? She has made this argument that this organization existed. She's made the argument that it was doing things that were corrupt, but she doesn't actually say what those things are. Bribery would be a crime, but there was no bribery allegations here. Threats, making threats could be a crime, but that wasn't alleged here. Calling the Secretary of State of Georgia and saying, "I need you to find votes," okay, really unseemly. Not sure it's a crime. There was no threat, there was no bribe, but that's one of the biggest things that Fannie Willis is pointing to say, well, that's one of the corrupt efforts that this organization engaged in. Anyway, I'm not convinced it's really going to hold up. I think at best, this was a number of conspiracies, most of which probably at the misdemeanor level. And I think she kind of rolled them all up and slapped a RICO label on it, which is felony, which is high profile. I'm not sure it really holds up under scrutiny. And RICO cases are historically complicated. They're usually highly specialized prosecutors in an office that just focus on those kinds of cases. So we'll see, but I think it's going to be, again, putting aside her personal problems, which already ate up a few months here, I think it's going to be very complicated and take a long time. So I think this will be well after this year's presidential election before this case kicks off. And I wouldn't be surprised one bit if it kind of falls apart. We've already had a few people plea to misdemeanors, no jail time. I think four of them out of the 19. I think you're going to kind of see that. I don't think it's going to be the big felony headline case against Donald Trump that it was kind of, sold as originally.
Now let's pivot to again another case that you said was weak, and then we'll get into the one that maybe should have never been brought in New York, which is coming up soon. So the weak one, January 6th, and one of the biggest takeaways for me was, and again, a lot of people with seething red of like insurrection. I saw it. I watched it play out on television, but he's charged with obstruction of an official proceeding, which is different than an insurrection, at least in my understanding and my bare bones knowledge of the criminal justice system and charges. So I'm curious for you for this case, because you mentioned it's one of the weaker ones, and we've seen already a delay in this case. It's been infinitely delayed. I think it's going to be in December where the case will at least be brought before. There's four federal charges right now. What do you make of this case overall, and where this will eventually net out in terms of the January 6th stuff?
I think I would label this in sort of the mid-level. Like it's got some potential, but there are some pretty big legal jumps that it requires. So I'd say it's shaky. And you're absolutely right, Mike. I mean, it's often referred to as the insurrection case, but Donald Trump has not been charged with insurrection. Insurrection is a very specific criminal law that has existed since the Civil War. It currently exists as 18 USC 2383. That's the statute. And Donald Trump has not been charged with that, nor have any of the 1,300 or so individuals who were involved in the Capitol riots. Not a single person has been charged with the crime of insurrection. You're exactly right. So what Jack Smith, and I'm sure it's not because Jack Smith didn't want to charge him with insurrection. I'm sure it's because they felt they couldn't prove it. So what they've done is they've combined, to your point, it's a combination of obstruction of Congress, fraud, and a civil rights statute from back, basically a Civil War era civil rights statute. I can see that. I can see where they're going. I think they're making the best of the fact that they didn't have the case they really wanted. And so they're trying to argue that Donald Trump set into motion events that were intended to do things like prevent Congress from counting the Electoral College votes. But that was the day that they were going to certify the election. The problem is, each one of these things has issues, right? The obstruction argument that you pointed out, the Supreme Court is currently considering the scope of that law in a separate case. So right now, the Supreme Court on its docket is trying to interpret how far the obstruction of an official proceeding statute can be brought. And I'm not sure it's going to make it. What Donald Trump did is going to make it into this interpretation. It's a bit of a stretch. It's a bit of a new use of the law. So I think right off the bat, we might find out before this case even begins what the Supreme Court thinks that statute applies to. And if the actions of January 6th don't fall within that charge could fall off right away. So that's hanging in the balance right there. Then you have the fraud allegation, which is basically that Donald Trump tried to defraud Congress by, again, impeding its efforts, impeding the truthful counting of the Electoral College votes. The problem there is that the Supreme Court has already held that the fraud statutes only apply to financial fraud. And this is not a financial fraud case. There's no financial aspect to this case. So that's a problem. And I expect that's going to be bitterly fought over. But that's a Supreme Court precedent just from a couple of years ago. I was surprised that Jack Smith brought that charge, knowing that that case had just been decided, I think, just in 2021. So that's going to be a fighting point. And then the last one are these civil rights laws, basically passed to fight against Ku Klux Klan efforts after the Civil War. The law is intended to prosecute people who prevent voters from going to the polls. But that's not what happened here. The argument is, it's well, it's, the argument here was the effort was to prevent people's votes from being counted, the votes that had already been made several months prior. It might work. It's never been tried before. So in each of these three, if you take each of the three legal theories here, maybe Jack Smith gets maybe they all go his way. And then the trial proceeds, and we see actually how it plays out. But I can see in all three cases, there's some questions whether they survive as charged. And so I think, again, this is going to be a long process where at least two of these arguments will go to the Supreme Court before, again, the trial can even start.
The through line that I'm taking away from this, and you don't have to answer, but it's more of like, it's never been tried before. We've never been here before. Like there's a lot of that in terms of it. And I'm glad you're here to explain a lot of it. All right, I want to get into the week one because I want to play something. It ties in perfectly because earlier this afternoon, in the New York case that's going to be happening, the criminal trial against the former president that's set to start next week, depending upon when you're listening to this recording. And so his lawyers for the former president, they tried, emergency delay of the criminal trial. It was denied by a judge. And again, they were trying to do it because they said an impartial jury cannot be selected right now based on the prejudicial pretrial publicity. Alliteration aside, I wanted to ask you because some of that publicity is because of the former president going out there and saying things like this.
A crooked New York state judge just ruled that I have to pay a fine of $355 million for having built a perfect company. Great cash, great buildings, great everything. It affects New York. It's mostly talking about New York, where we have a totally corrupt attorney general. She campaigned on the fact that I will get Trump, I will get Trump. Everybody's seen it, Letitia James. They've all seen it. Well, we'll be appealing, but more important than that, this is Russia, this is China, this is the same game. All comes out of the DOJ, it all comes out of Biden. It's a witch hunt against his political opponent.
Now, I know obviously that was after the civil trial happened, but you get a little bit of what I'm trying to get at here, which is twofold, because you're a former federal prosecutor. Here's the person that you're trying on this trial coming up. And this person is saying, again, different case, because obviously Alvin Bragg is the Manhattan district attorney in this. But, this is crooked. This is set up. The judge is in on it. How much of that, how hard is that as a federal prosecutor? What would Joseph Moreno be doing right now in his office? I mean, I see him in his office right now. If you're watching us on YouTube, he's writing notes. So are you watching the defendant say some of these things on TV? What is your team? Are you using any of that ammunition when you go before the court, before the bench, and when they're trying to argue something like this, which is we can't start because there's too much publicity around it? Yeah. Here's exhibit A, like of your client. What do you make of that? And then funnel into the trial itself, because you have said that this is
probably the weakest, and a lot of legal analysts have agreed with you, of something that maybe shouldn't have been brought in, statute of limitations, et cetera. I would love for you to get into a little bit more of the New York case that's starting up soon.
Well, as far as the pretrial publicity, I think that prosecutors in each one of these cases made the very deliberate decision to indict these cases in 2023 so that they would go to trial in 2024 before the election. And I think that if you don't believe the timing of the indictments were intentional, then I think you look at the efforts that each one of these cases where prosecutors are just fighting tooth and nail to get them docketed before November. And so that's very purposeful. And I'm not going to try to read the minds of these prosecutors, but I will interpret their actions as saying that they want to get them done before the election. And look, that's not an appropriate method for a prosecutor to follow. A prosecutor, the timing of an election should have nothing to do with when a case should be charged and brought to trial. All that should be, the only factors that a prosecutor should consider is, has it gathered the evidence that the prosecution office believes it needs to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt? Has it respected a defendant's right to a speedy trial, meaning that you haven't sat on things for years? And then once you have charged it, have you given the defense adequate time to prepare? Those are the factors that a prosecutor at any level, federal or state, should factor in. And that's it. It's not the timing of a presidential campaign. It's not an election or whether or not you think it's your job to block someone from being elected or anything like that. So I have a hard time saying then, when you see the prosecutors have done this very purposefully, to then say Donald Trump shouldn't be allowed to go out and talk about this stuff. Because Joe Biden can go out and talk about this stuff. Merrick Garland can talk about it. So I would come down on the side of giving Trump a lot of leniency and say, look, we chose to do this. We're fighting. We could wait till next year, right? I mean, once the cases are indicted, the statute of limitations stops. You can try the case whenever you want. So, but they're fighting to do it now. So I don't think it's fair then to say, well, Trump can't go out and talk about it. Anything, to your point, Mike, anything Trump says is admissible in court. So if I was the prosecutor, I'd probably sit back and say, you know what, let him go. And if he says something stupid, I'm going to present it to the jury in a few weeks when the trial starts. So I think these gag orders, I think the complaining about what he's saying, it really cuts into First Amendment concerns. It really cuts into blurring the line between law and politics. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, if I were these prosecutors, I would not have rushed these trials before an election, and I would not now try to hamstring Donald Trump, which is probably a lost cause anyway. He's going to do what he wants to do. I would sit back, I would build my case, and I would let him kind of, you know, go off and do his thing. And if he gets out of line, I would raise it before the jury and make sure that they hear it.
And in the New York case that's about to start this coming week, why do you think it's still? And again, we've heard this again. We've had other former DOJ prosecutors on, criminal defense attorneys. We've heard this refrain over and over that this is the weakest, but it was the one that was brought first. Was it brought first because it's so weak that the prosecutor in this case felt like they could get something before, you know, the November election? What's your read on, and why is it the weakest of the cases? Or why would Joseph Moreno not have brought this case against the former president?
So first off, the facts underlying this case are old. This is the Stormy Daniels hush money payments case, right? The underlying transactions that Alvin Bragg is alleging were criminal occurred in late 2016 and early 2017. Right, regarding the 2016 election. That's 8 years ago now. That's 7 years before this case was indicted. So right off the bat, you have to say, okay, why did Alvin Bragg wait 7 years to indict this case and then do it a year before election? So right off the bat, that should kind of make you scratch your head and say, well, what's going on here? Okay. And then the other question is, well, how did Alvin Bragg get past a 5-year statute of limitations if this case is now going on 7 years, right, before it was charged? And so that also requires some very, very creative legal theory, which also, you know, I think is really kind of weak. What Alvin Bragg has done is he's taken a case with alleged accounting irregularities in a private company, which is a 2-year statute of limitations misdemeanor. And he's tied it to a felony theory that if the misdemeanor accounting fraud was done with the intent of covering up another crime, that makes it a felony. And then when he was asked, well, what's the other crime that Donald Trump is supposed to have intended to commit by virtue of the accounting irregularities, Bragg's answer was campaign finance violations, right? The idea was that he hid the nature of the hush money payments. He camouflaged them in his accounting records because he didn't want them to show up as campaign expenditures, as in like he donated his own money for purposes of getting elected. And that's why he hid the payments to Stormy Daniels. Problem is, campaign finance is a federal crime. So Alvin Bragg has not only now had this very creative method of trying to bootstrap felony charges onto what really should be a misdemeanor, but then he's coupling state accounting laws with federal campaign finance laws. Very, very creative. Unimaginable this would have been brought against anyone other than Donald Trump. And I'll add, federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, they looked at this case years ago for potential campaign finance violations, and they passed on it. And if anyone was going to charge this case as a federal campaign finance violation, it should be federal prosecutors, because they're the ones who enforce federal law. So the timing of it, the creative nature of it, the doing all he can to convert what at best should be a slap on the wrist misdemeanor accounting violation into a 34 felony count indictment, which, by the way, also, you're not supposed to, as a prosecutor, this is an aside, you're not supposed to overcharge. So you're not supposed to take a felony and then break it up to make it look like it's many charges. And what Alvin Bragg has done here is he has charged each entry in the accounting books as an individual felony. So, and it's two for each one. So if there were 17 payments to Stormy Daniels, or I should say to Michael Cohen to reimburse him for having paid Stormy Daniels, each one is charged twice. And that's how he gets to 34. So not only is the timing really suspect, the way he charged it is against any basic premise of how prosecutors are supposed to act. So in the big picture, I think, look, Bragg might get a conviction. I mean, I'm not saying that he won't actually get a conviction against Trump. A New York jury might buy this theory, and they might say Trump is guilty, and they might, you know, they might convict him. My problem is the timing, the creativity, and the fact that to charge Trump for spending his own money, he didn't spend campaign funds, this was his own money, pay hush money, which is legal, might be tawdry, but it is legal to pay someone to sign an NDA. That's what hush money is, really. And to say that because he booked it in the books of his private company, that somehow that's a campaign finance violation, I think it's just really outrageous.
This is why we have this man on. He breaks it down here. I'm thinking of maybe a podcast to Leon Media Network with Joseph Moreno, maybe Blinding Justice or something like that. We're going to brainstorm on some of this. Joseph, I can't thank you enough for hopping on the podcast. Former federal prosecutor. Go follow him across social media. Check out all his TV hits. Thank you for coming on and giving us a couple minutes. Continued success to you, my friend. Be safe.
Mike, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
All right, our thank yous there to Joseph Moreno. Like I mentioned, former federal prosecutor. Go follow him on Twitter. I don't know if he's on Instagram. I know he's on Twitter. So go follow him over on Twitter. Worked for the Department of Justice. He even worked for the 9/11 Review Commission, the second one. Big time former federal prosecutor. Can't thank him enough for hopping on the podcast. Some really good stuff there. I'm interested if you've got any takes about the cases themselves, the legalities around the case. You know, there could be people listening to this and say, yeah, it's all politically motivated. I agree with him on the politically motivated stuff. Then there's people that would be like, no, I agree with him on the righteous case. Like he said about, you know, the Mar-a-Lago documents. It's a crime. You shouldn't have these documents. They tried to get it back. He didn't give them back. Crime. Lock them up. However you feel, email us, canweplealktalkpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, not only of what you thought of the interview, of the cases. You got any questions for Nick and I, feel free to email us. And while you're emailing us, head over to our YouTube channel, type in Can We Please Talk Podcast. We should pop right up. Hit the subscribe button for me while you're there. Audio podcast platforms, you know them by now, Apple, Spotify, Google. Shout out to everybody that listens to us over on Good Pods. Shout out to Acast, our hosting platform. We can't do it without them. Can't do it without each and every one of you that listens to this program. As always, I am Mike Leon. We will see everybody next time.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.